So I asked the panelists to introduce themselves and talk about their work in about 5 minutes, so fairly briefly, and then I'll ask them one question, and then we'll kind of open it up and hopefully make it a good discussion. So I'm going to start to my left, Mark Williams. Look at this.
Mark Williams, Director of Career Service at the Community College of Baltimore County and Project Director for the Male Student Success Initiative. We target African-American males based on the issues that we found and the data from our school. We found that we need a program to help them persist first semester to the second semester to the third semester. One of the things that Jamie and I have worked on is trying to get our students into acceleration as early as 2009, we begin to scale it up. At the same time, we scaled up an orientation course for black males. And one of the things we did in that course was actually look at their schedule to see how they were registered for accelerated courses. And we found that many of our black males were not even told about the accelerated courses. And at that time, we hadn't scaled it up to the point that we've scaled it up now, but still, they weren't advised to go into accelerated. Their advisors told them, these are the courses that you need. So they weren't given a choice. So one of the things that we did in the program was to train our case managers in academic advising so that when our students went to take the placement test, they came back to see us instead of to the advisors. And then that was the way that we were able to transition our men into the accelerated courses. We got a grant from the Maryland Higher Education Commission in 2014 to create this program. And one of the requirements of the program was for the students to be in accelerated English and reading. We looked at putting them into accelerated math, but we did find that they were not as successful in accelerated math as they were in accelerated English and reading. So we kind of backed off the math piece and kind of pressed them to take the accelerated reading in English. So now everybody is pretty much required to take acceleration at CCBC. Thank you.
You want me to go?
I'm not good with transitions, so.
Okay. I'm Katie Hearn. I'm the co-founder of the California Acceleration Project, and I just want to sort of ground my own work in relation to equity. So we always start by acknowledging that the way that we set up developmental education was intended to help students be more successful in college. That was where we were coming from over the last 30-year history that Peter sketched out. But what we didn't realize at the time was the unintended consequence that with each remedial course required, each level that we required students to go through, they were less likely to earn a degree. And it's even a single layer of remediation makes them less likely to earn a degree. And so that's our sort of our grounding starting point in CAP. And then we're also looking at that there are real equity implications to that system. And so nationally, students of color are much more likely to be excluded from college-level courses and placed into remediation. And then they're also much more likely to be required to take multiple remedial courses. And with every course required, their chances of getting anywhere in college go down. Just to illustrate that a little bit, in statewide data in California in math, is that more than 50% of our black and Hispanic students are placed into three or more levels below a transfer level course in math, a BA degree applicable course in math. Just think about that. And they have no shot of going on to earn a degree. In 3 years, less than 10% of them will even complete a transferable math course, and most will just leave. So it's a huge driver of the racial inequities in long-term college completion is how we're placing students and disproportionately placing our students of color into lower layers of remediation. There's a researcher in California who studied that. He looked at students' trajectory and he said, we have these racial achievement gaps in long-term completion, degree completion, and he tried to sort of isolate where in students' trajectory at the college is it happening. Is it that we're not attracting and enrolling a diverse body of students? He said, no, it's not that. Is it in the last 15 units of their time here? No, those are pretty equitable results. And he isolated that 50 to 60% of the long-term completion inequities are driven by students' initial placement. That's what's driving 50% of the long-term racial completion inequities. I hadn't looked at this in terms of my own college until 2014, even though I was very active in acceleration, I hadn't turned it to the question of who gets into college English. And I looked at that in fall 2014. It was pretty shocking what I found at my own college. We were keeping the gate to college English incredibly narrow. So only 20% of students were allowed into college English at the time in fall 2014 at my college, Chabot. But then when we broke it out by race and ethnicity, it was 40% of white students. And it was 16 to 18% of every other group. So white students were more than twice as likely to be placed into college English, where their chances of actually getting somewhere in college were far better than students who were excluded. We still have a problem with that. We have not solved that in my own college. In California, all community colleges are required to submit equity plans and look at our data, and we also get funding to do equity programming, but at a lot of colleges, that funding has tended to really emphasize sort of co-curricular wraparound supports, learning communities, sort of counseling, African-American student graduations, all of which is wonderful and does a lot, I think, to create a different campus climate. But we're not tending to see colleges look at, and also there's some attention to sort of culturally responsive teaching practices, so sort of pedagogical support, and that's also incredibly important work. But the thing that we're trying to help colleges recognize is that if we don't change the structural inequities of our placement and remediation system, all of the good teaching and wraparound supports will never produce gains in students' completion. So that we have to be coupling the sort of structural reform of acceleration through placement changes and remediation restructuring with those kinds of additional supports for students to really see the kinds of gains that we need to see. There's a lot of promise that we're seeing in California of colleges that are making big changes, big acceleration-related changes, and seeing significant reductions in achievement gaps. So Butte College just doubled the number of students that got into college English. They were switching from one placement test to another, and instead of 23% of incoming students getting into college English, it was like almost half. And they found a year later that African American completion of college English tripled with that one big change. Just let more of them into college English, and African Americans were the ones who benefited the most from that change. Their completion tripled, Hispanic and Asian completion doubled, and white students did better too, 1.6 times higher. But white students were disproportionately advantaged by the old placement policy. And our students of color were disproportionately harmed by the old placement policy. So we saw bigger gains. Everybody did better. Nobody's harmed. But the gains helped to reduce the gaps. Also in the California Acceleration Project early math work, the first 8 colleges that implemented accelerated redesign statistics pathways for students, achievement gap and completion of a college level math course was eliminated for African American students across 8 colleges. And they had been the one most suffering under the traditional model of remediation. So that's the promise of this work. And then think about combining those sorts of structural changes with all the beautiful work that's underway in terms of culturally responsive teaching and wraparound supports and African American graduations and all of that stuff, the power that we could harness together to really make a difference for all of our students in completion.
So, good afternoon. My name is Nikki Edgecombe. I work at the Community College Research Center. I want to frame my comments a bit more globally. So I think Mark and Katie have brought do tremendous work on the ground with institutions, with students, to support more equitable outcomes. And then with CAP's work, obviously, in service of a more accelerated pathway to college-level coursework. I want to kind of reframe where this amazing work is happening. It's happening in institutions, two-year institutions that serve over half of all Hispanic students enrolled in undergraduate education, and nearly half of all Black students and low-income students enrolled as undergraduates in the country, right? So you think about the roles of the two-year colleges, the roles of the community colleges nationally, within a context where the demographic changes are making our undergraduate enrollees over time browner and blacker. And our community colleges are the ones that are going to disproportionately serve those populations over the next decades. And so when we think about outcomes writ large not being equitable, degree attainment, those kind of larger statistical analyses that we oftentimes see discussed in the popular press, I always like to try to make sure we're grounding those conversations within the very specific and oftentimes very differentiated context, particularly of our public community colleges. These institutions are doing yeoman's work without many resources, and we've got to figure out ways, and I think we're beginning to see ways to support stronger and more equitable outcomes. But there is a danger in this work, and some of our work, which we presented earlier today, talks about within the developmental education reform context, we want to be sure that more positive outcomes in the aggregate are not obscuring widening of achievement gaps depending on the outcome. So maybe it's gatekeeper math or English, maybe it's credit productivity, how many credits different populations are college credit students are completing versus attempted, other measures that get us at the persistence that we know is going to be critical for college completion. And the other piece that we began in partnership with institutions studying their reforms of developmental education many years ago, and one of the hard lessons that we've had to learn as part of that is there is no developmental education reform alone that is going to substantially improve completion. It's got to operate in concert with a range of supports that help students decide on and get into more structured and coherent pathways, majors. And those majors, those pathways, need to be buttressed by a range of academic and non-academic supports that can change over time depending on where the student is in his or her college career. So I want to make sure that we kind of understand that neither developmental education, the great work that's happening in acceleration is bears the full burden of equitable outcomes. But because developmental education, and to Katie's point, assessment and placement are inextricably linked, we're dealing on the front lines, not simply of that leaky course sequence that we are all aware of and that a lot of us are working to address, but of a fundamentally extraordinarily vulnerable assessment and placement system that is disadvantaging particularly students of color and low-income students. And so when we talk about our work here, and a lot of times we don't have a lot of policy latitude around assessment and placement, I recognize that, but probably the most important work I think we can do in what I'll call, acceleration 2.0 is around beginning to address those issues with assessment and placement. The Century Foundation published a report back in 2013 called Bridging the Higher Education Divide, Strengthening Community College and Restoring the American Dream. And that report was interesting in a lot of ways, but what it speaks to is a broader conversation happening within education, pre-K through 20. But this notion of ensuring that our institutions are not reproducing the social inequities that we live with every day. And so when you think about that demographic composition of community colleges that I described as I started my remarks, you know, I want you to think about these institutions. If we're talking about institutions that at the six-year mark, on average, nationally, when we combine both completion and transfer, are getting about 40%, 4 in 10 of our students through to further education or a completed credential, we've got a lot of work to do. And we know those numbers are significantly lower for our students of color and our low-income students. And so while the work within the developmental education space is critical to beginning to address many of these inequities, I want us to all keep in mind and keep our eye broadly on our institutions to ensure that there aren't other policy and policy mechanisms, practices that are fundamentally reproducing a lot of these social inequities. I think that was the Century Report, Century Foundation report was unequivocal in the fact that despite the powerful intended mission of community colleges, increasing educational opportunity, supporting economic mobility, in fact, we were not doing that as effectively and for as many students and certainly certain student populations as we can. So our work, and you'll see it coming out of the Community College Research Center probably, I guess, intensely over the next year or so, will talk a lot about how we can begin within our institutions to look at the outcomes of different student populations and think about what outcomes make sense for kind of judging where students are as they move their way through their college career. And they're intended to be the types of reports and publications that you all can take and replicate at your institution. We are, on the whole, staying away from ridiculously complex statistical analyses and really just sticking with the basics here so that institutions can take the lead in looking internally to better understand how, whether certainly developmental education reform that many of your institutions are involved in, guided pathways work, revised advising systems, other things that are quite consequential to students' ultimate outcomes. And so understanding how all of these things are playing out and how students are experiencing them is an important piece of the puzzle.
Thank you. All right, so if you have any questions or comments, you could just raise your hand. We have two people with microphones. While you're thinking of questions and formulating those, I do have one question. I was struck by, I went to Nikki Edgecombe's presentation. I was really struck by the fact that in math, the gap after the reform in Virginia was actually wider. It widened. So is the answer, it seemed like the answer for placement issues for both Katie and Peter was to kind of open the gates and let them all in, and you know they'll be better served, they'll be more successful, even though some will not succeed. They'll be more successful than they are now. Is math different? Is there something fundamentally different? And I don't know if anybody else could answer that.
So just by way of background, we were presenting data from a study that is funded by the Gates Foundation called the Analysis of Statewide Developmental Education Reform. This study looked at the redesigns of DEBED in Virginia and North Carolina. Within Virginia, they, on the math side, for those who aren't familiar, they modularized their developmental math. So the theory behind that was let's kind of chunk up the curriculum into smaller units, allow students from the assessment perspective to test around that content, show proficiency or not, and then students would only have to take the math they need, theoretically. And what they need is also aligned to their program of study, and the split is basically STEM versus liberal arts. So what the redesign included as well was a change of the prerequisite requirement for the liberal arts math course offered across community colleges in the state. reduced from including intermediate algebra to the equivalent of beginning algebra, but it is delivered through this modularized system. So one of the things that we saw in when we analyzed aggregate outcomes post-redesign, early cohorts, early data, relatively short timeline, was about an 8% increase in the percentage of students statewide who were completing their developmental math introductory college-level course within a year. When we disaggregated that data by race, what we found was a gap between white students and black students that increased from a percentage point standpoint. So the difference between those pass rates pre-redesign I think was 14 percentage points, and that increased to 17 percentage points post-redesign. Now, a couple of caveats with that analysis. Those rates can fluctuate. We've tracked them longer term, but those rates, if you want to understand those differences, those gaps, can fluctuate. So it's important that you don't simply look once, right? You want to be looking over time and understanding what the trend is as well. What we also found, for example, is that within math, the gap also grew between low-income students, those identified as Pell recipients versus non-Pell recipients. It grew more, right? So in aggregate, you look at the data, it looks like things are going well. In writ large, they are. You know, I think the question is, at an institutional level, when the data isn't as disaggregated, when it's kind of classroom by classroom, section by section, student by student, to ensure that across your student population, students are benefiting, hopefully in equitable ways, from the work that you all are doing on the ground. So I think part of the tension that exists is, so for example, with co-requisite models, nationally, pass rates tend to be in the 60-something, mid-60%. That means there's about 35% of students who, for whatever reason, may not be successful in that model. If your goal is to get more students through, you oftentimes accept some of that, some of those unsuccessful students for this larger goal of having a larger number, sheer absolute number of students completing Gatekeeper Math or English. I would say yes, and let's do two things. One, figure out who those students are that aren't successful in that model, and figure out what we may need to do to support them. So I think it gets to Peter's early comment, which is we still do have a lot of work to do to understand certainly students who, in a perfect world, and we were able to assess them accurately, probably have significant remedial needs. Absolutely, though we're challenged to actually assess that accurately. But more generally, for the students for whom these models aren't successful, we need to think about institutionally what we can do to support them. And it is probably in the spirit of what is built behind a lot of the DevEd reform, not the same thing, right? So trying to figure out what that is and who those students are is an important piece.
Okay. Yes, there's a question up here, Susan. And Elsbeth, there was one in the middle. I'm not sure my question got answered, John.
Is math
fundamentally different than English? Is there some different approach?
So she was talking about the Virginia study, which is a particular model, and in that model, everybody's completion did go up. So that's the sort of the first thing we need to watch for. Every racial group benefited.
Right.
But when you're comparing the benefits across groups, the gap between the white and black students widened a little bit. Now that's not true in all of math. So the data that I shared from the CAP program is that is absolutely not true. And in math, we have the best evidence of narrowing achievement gap through these solutions. So I think it's really, I think the larger point that I think both Nikki and I would make is that colleges should be watching this, that you shouldn't just be looking at your overall data on these interventions. You should be disaggregating it by race and pay attention to that and pay attention to, is it, so the first bottom line is everybody better? Everybody doing better? That should be your first checklist. If not, look at that again. Like, what do you need to do? But then if everybody is, then you say, well, are the gaps equal? Are they narrowing? You hope they're narrowing, you know, and you hope they're narrowing a lot. Best case scenario, you're eliminating. And if they're not, try to learn why. And is there an additional step that you could take? The existence of a gap is not inherently a problem. I want to give you one example to just illustrate that. We asked colleges to tell us about their placement policies at CAP events last spring, and we actually mapped them on a spectrum. And in math, it was very, we had like, do 100% of your students get into transfer level math? Do 0% of your students get into transfer level math? And then we made them come with their data, and it had to be disaggregated so we could do some, have some conversations. And one college, it had no achievement gap for their students of color in access to the transfer level math course. Zero. But we were not celebrating that college, because they let less than 1% of their incoming students into transfer level math. So there was no gap because they were all fucked. So it's like, so I think like when that college, as it moves forward, it's going to suddenly see equity gaps, but that doesn't mean that like they should go back to what they were doing. It's sort of like they just need to monitor that and work on that over time. So I just think it's like the gaps need to be looked at in the context of, is everybody better off? Okay, we've met that line. Now, what do we need to look at?
Great. Thank you. I feel much better now.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Kate.
Okay. My question is sort of a two-part question. Our school has just joined the bandwagon for the guided pathways. And my concern is that, first of all, it's yet another program that's funded by a millionaire. And I really am not convinced that the millionaires really have equity in mind. I think they have bottom line capitalism in mind. And I wonder what we as community colleges are doing when we're accepting this money in these programs. Or maybe I'm just being a reactionary, I don't know. So I want your opinion on that. And the other part is, even the guided pathway seems to me, I can envision, because right now, so many colleges, including community colleges, are being pressured about success rate, et cetera. And of course we should be concerned about success. But at a community college, as we all know, there are lots of different definitions of success. And we have seen lots of students who start way, way below where they ought to be. And by the time they're done, they're incredible. We are fulfilling the mission that we're supposed to. My concern about this guided pathways is eventually, because of the success thing, people are going to look at students who come in and who are at such and such a level, and they're going to just sort of decide for that student, well, for you to be successful here, let's put you in this one-year certificate program where you can learn and earn a whopping $14,000 a year and be poor the rest of your life. But we will be able to say you succeeded and got your certificate. So I'm just wondering, again, am I being just a reactionary? Or is this something that really I should be pushing against? Thank you.
Well, since my colleagues wrote a big old book on guided pathways, I'll defend them a little bit, starting with the fact that since billionaires butter my bread every day, I have to carefully tread what I say and don't say. Any reform can and likely will have unintended consequences. So remember, you know, let's harken back to history. We were once about access. And we were once about, then there was a completion agenda. And that wasn't specific enough, so we need some guided pathways now to get us to that completion agenda. And there are inherent risks to how institutions and systems approach this work. And we've certainly seen contexts where certificates that do not generate family-sustaining wage have been waived as success. So that's certainly not the vision of, I would say at least I can only speak for CCRC, the CCRC version of guided pathways. That said, I will say our research suggests the complexity and lack of coherence, even though we have them written on our websites, and you can go and look at them, but The ability to turn that information into a coherent program of study that you can follow easily is a huge obstacle for a lot of our students. And I think it is probably part of the solution. And like pretty much any change, it can be done masterfully well or horribly wrong. And I think we need people on the ground who are going to ask the hard questions to ensure that we don't move in the horribly wrong direction. But I think conceptually, if you look nationally and talk to states and institutions within them and students within those institutions, you recognize that we didn't necessarily have a very coherent path towards completion, even when we said our next focus is the completion agenda. So I don't know what, I'm sure there's going to be something else layered on top of guided pathways and other things that happen over time.
I worry about directing students away from where they really have capacity, but we're already doing that with our use of standardized placement testing and our remedial course structures. That's on us. Like, we already are responsible. So our current system is already tracking students away from any hope of a family sustaining wage because they can't get through college. So I share the concern that you're expressing, but if what results from expressing that concern is that we protect the current system, then I'm not with you there. Like, we have a responsibility for changing the ways our systems that we created are not serving students. And we as faculty need to be committed to that and on the ground about that. And because that's what our mission is. Because I believe in the mission of community colleges. I believe in the mission of providing access to a higher education to students from across, and what that means for their chance of a life-sustaining wage like that. I believe in all of that. And DevEd is currently not working in the service of that. The way we've designed it is not working in the service of that. So that's my sort of fundamental starting point for that, for the conversation you're posing.
We had about 3,500 general study students walking out door last fall. And those students were not the ones who knew they wanted to transfer. And so that we needed to create an idea for them of what direction they needed to go to, what they were looking at. And so the pathways kind of clarified for them, okay, this might be my direction. There are choices within this pathway, but at least I have some focus. Before that, a lot of our general studies students were floundering, even beyond DevEd, because they didn't have a pathway. They might have had a major, but after a semester or two, that might not have stuck. And so at least it guided them to say, okay, if I can't do this, I can at least do that in the same life. So if I want to be in healthcare, I might not be able to get into the nursing program, but there's another program where I can actually do something else within the healthcare field. So it kind of clarified some things for those students who had no clue.
Okay, so we have a question over here.
Yes. Is on? Okay. So I'm Lexa Logue from the City University of New York. I'm here with my colleague Mari Watanabe-Rose.
Woohoo!
And I just wanted to add some hopeful math data. Some people here know about this already, but addressing the issue that was of concern here. So we did a randomized controlled trial where we randomly assigned students who'd been assessed as needing elementary remedial algebra instead to statistics, college-level statistics with extra support. And it turned out that students who were randomly assigned to statistics passed that course at a higher rate, a significantly higher rate, than students who took the traditional remedial algebra course, and there were no differences according to race or ethnicity for what we did, which therefore suggests that if this were widely applied, it would help to decrease performance gaps. And we're giving follow-up data on this experiment tomorrow in a poster, and the original data are being published next week in Educational Evaluation and Policy Analysis. That's the end of my pitch.
Excellent. Thank you. So I had a question I wanted to ask, starting with Mark. So I'm a classroom teacher. I spend most of my life in the classroom. So I think it's really important to think about how we can help people when we're in the classroom. And I know you work with young men, and that's our huge concern, is we're seeing not enough young men complete. So do you think that there's an importance in what we do as classroom teachers, things like culturally responsive teaching? Are those going to help us in this venture?
That's very important. I'm going to step back a second. I talked to the administrator of our testing center and asked her, was their question on race, does the Accuplacia ask the student their race? She said yes. And the work that Claude Steele does shows that there is this issue of stereotype threat, okay? And so it's key that we teach our students that while we're in the classroom. Now, I don't know how much of an impact that has on our students who take the placement test, but I believe it has some level of impact. Okay, so if we have an understanding of what culturally responsive teaching does for students, not just for us, but for students, it's valuable for us to teach them things like stereotype threat, mindset, social capital. And so in our orientation course for black males, we do just that. The faculty are taught culturally responsive techniques in the classroom, and then we turn around and teach the students that too. Okay? Unfortunately, we don't get to teach them that before they sit and take the placement test. But that would be very important to say, okay, look, maybe we should remove that question off the placement test and see what the difference is.
Any insight on that, Katie?
The sort of fundamental concepts of belonging, creating a sense of belonging in your classroom, I think that every teacher creating that and making students feel that and relationship building, both between the students and the teacher and also with each other, sort of fostering that in the classroom, really can make a difference in just the sort of success rates of each individual class, which then accumulates into hopefully progress. There's a writer named Zaretta Hammond, and she's out of Oakland, California, African-American woman, and she has a book called Culturally Responsive Teaching in the Brain that I really like some of the way she talks about this. She said, we often think of culturally responsive teaching as like making your math classes be about Egypt or Africa, or, you know, and then that's a piece of it, is like, you know, content, just to see themselves in the content of the readings you get. But she also just talks about that it's also about having engagement strategies. So do you pedagogical techniques around things like she calls it like gamify and storify and make it social. Like so that students have a way to interact with the material of the class. And a lot of my students are much more comfortable with oral expression than written academic expression. So sort of harnessing their ability to express something orally as a precursor and sort of pre-writing to a more formal academic expression, so that all those things, like what do we do in the classroom that make it possible for a broader array of students to successfully engage the rigorous content of our class, and really thinking about our responsibility to do that as teachers.
And I would definitely argue that with ALP, that's part of what's successful about the model, is you have this 8, 10, 12 student small group, that it's much easier to form that cohesion and that kind of type of group dynamic. Do we have any?
Can I say one more thing about the faculty responsibility? That's the classroom piece of it, but I think it's also beyond our own individual classrooms, is asking the questions. But like, I'd like everybody at this conference to go back and ask your IR office for data on placement disaggregated by race. And sort of looking at, if you're like most institutions in California, you're black and brown students concentrated in the lower level. So even if you've accelerated, do you maintain a lower level? And who's in that? And is it disproportionate? Chances are it is. So just go home and think about that, because for me, that's like the cleanest example of institutional racism I've seen, that I just encountered in my life, because we're using bogus, illegitimate standardized placement tests to make these high-stakes decisions that make students less likely to be successful. And we all need, that's us, that's on us, those are our systems, and I think it's our responsibility as faculty members to know that data and start agitating to change that and no longer allow certain groups of students to be concentrated in parts of our institution where they don't have a shot.
There you go. So Does anybody have any questions? I have questions, so don't worry. Don't worry, I got you covered. Okay, we have a question back there. Elizabeth can run. It's okay. Or maybe she can.
There was a study, and I might be misinterpreting it, and I talked to you about it a minute yesterday, Katie, that came out of Wisconsin, I think Holly Hassel, and it seemed to suggest, at least to me, that when students are placed, students that are testing in at the lower level, according to AccuPlacer, right, are overplaced, that they do worse, right? And so I know some colleges are dumping all developmental students into like the one co-requisite class. I guess my question is do we know for sure what's happening with the students that are testing in at that level? Do we know that they're not performing as well if they're put into one co-requisite class? And that's one of the questions that I came to this conference with, and I don't know if anyone can answer that. And then the question would be, of course, then is that class serving them the best, or do we need to come up with another class that sort of helps those students more effectively? And hopefully that's clear.
Well, so nationally, lower placed students, the problems with our assessment and placement system aside, lower placed students are less likely to succeed now.
In any curricular structure.
In any curricular structure. But certainly in the status quo multi-course, multi-sequence developmental course pathway, we know that's the case. We've, across pretty much all of our evaluations of institutional or statewide DevEd reforms that we've done, we've tried to look at those students who place lowest, and their success rates are always lower.
Lower than high scoring students.
What's that?
Lower than high scoring students.
Right.
But not lower than they did in the old model.
Right. So, but I think that's the tension, right? So the, well, within the new model, that still holds. So I probably have a teeny bit more faith in some of the assessment instruments than Katie does, not from the sense of placement, because those are our decisions. Where we set a cut score, that's completely on us. But do they measure something? Probably. Yes, the students who place lower, even in the co-requisite model, may have lower success rates, though that group can be heterogeneous. It's not simply, you know, the lower placed students. The lowest placed according to the placement test, right? So if you think of all of the students in DevEd, the ones down here, right? They do make up a significant portion of, let's call it, the 35% who aren't successful in a co-requisite model, but they aren't necessarily all of them. So the solution may be about the level of developmental need, but it may be about something else as well. So I think it's difficult to say, but the practitioners on the ground, the institutions on the ground, are the ones best positioned to try to formulate solutions for those students.
But remember, you're saying low scoring students do less well than high scoring students. Well, a student with dyslexia struggles more than a student who doesn't have, you know, like,
right,
of course. Yeah, and there's the students, some you have really strong students, some really weak students. So, but when you say, okay, really low scoring students, how do they do in the accelerated approach compared to how those same students do in the non-accelerated traditional models? They do better. So it's not like we need to go back to the old way because this isn't working. I just want to be, you're not asking that, but I want to make that really clear.
Yes.
For everybody else, that all of the studies are showing, studies that CCRC did of my college. I mean, there are faculty on my campus that are sure that learning disabled students should not be in our accelerated course, or that ESL students should not be in our accelerated course, or, you know, and every study we've done internally, CCRC studies, the RP group study of the first 16 CAP colleges, every student group we've isolated, including students with disabilities, they're all doing better in the accelerated pathway. So that's just a sort of a bottom line empirical basis I would like us to all share when we start to talk about, well, what about the students who have higher needs? How can we, going back to the old system is not the solution. But studying what they need and thinking about new ways to better support them, I'm down for that. Like, that might be a pedagogical, it might be faculty training, it might be embedded student services support, it might be a lot of things, but it's not what we used to do.
Okay, so it seems like, to me, it seems like basic writing faculty are disproportionately white, and they serve a disproportionately diverse student body. So do you think it's important to try to diversify faculty, and if so, how do we do that?
From my perspective, and what my students tell me, it's more about how the faculty member engages the students and how much the faculty member cares about the students. I don't really care what color you are, where you come from. Do you care about the students? Are you providing them early alert within the classroom? Okay, if you're not doing that, it really doesn't matter, because you can have black instructors not doing those things, not caring, not engaging them in the classroom. So my thing is really, yes, diversity is great. Students need to see advisors that look like them well before they get to the classroom, because those are the cultural navigators of the college. But other than that, it's about how much do you care? How much do you engage the students? You know, how much are you talking to them? How much do you know their names, what they're doing outside of the classroom? If you're doing those things, they will ask you questions. They will seek help.
Great answer.
I totally agree with that and feel relieved about that as a white teacher. But I will also say that I think some of the I was reading a research study about who gets defined as gifted, and what helped students of color be more likely to be defined as gifted is that they're in a classroom with a faculty member of color. It's actually the faculty of color were more likely to see students of color as gifted than white teachers were. And so I just want to, as a white person, I feel like I want to name that for all of us. Like, so I do totally believe that, but I also believe that implicit bias exists, and there's all sorts of, it's very complicated. So I do want us to take active steps to diversify our faculty so that our departmental conversations are enriched by the experience they bring, and so that the students are more likely to be seen as gifted. And those, all of those.
Unfortunately, you know, we have an orientation course for black males taught by black instructors, okay? Because that may be the only black instructor they get while they're at the college. And so they need them first to teach them social capital, to be able to look outside of their race for support. Otherwise, they may never see anyone who looks like them. And so why am I here?
Well, and you know, I mean, when you think about our completion rates and the completion rates of people of color, we're not really setting up a large cadre of the next generation of community college instructors. And we very well could be. But I don't want Katie's line towards the end to actually get thrown away. I think there's a powerful body of research around classroom bias and the like. And I think understanding our own belief systems is a critical piece to that. Now remember, you have a belief system as the instructor. Your student may come with a belief system, perhaps reflecting stereotype threat. And so we've got a lot of things kind of going on there. You're not necessarily going to solve that, but imagine a more diversified faculty collaborative and the types of conversations that can happen among faculty that can help support what we do in the classroom. I think that is kind of our first line of defense here. So, you know, students, when they talk about the traits that they value in their instructors, race doesn't come up unless it happens to be a same race teacher that also has all those traits. So there's these traits, the caring, the understanding, the willingness. Students respond to instructors they feel are giving them a lot. They feel licensed to give back. And that means work, right? That means engaging. So to be able to leverage a diversity of perspectives from a faculty collaboration and growth perspective, from a professional learning perspective, to me, seems actually like the space in which I think we could do tremendous work. Teacher effects vary. There are some faculty who seem to do extraordinarily well with students of color, low-income students, and others who don't do as well. And we don't truly understand why. So being able to learn from one another, I think, is a critical piece of that.
So I'm going to ask in a second each of you to give one concluding sentence and just a final thought. But before you do, while you're thinking of that, I just want to read what my student wrote for us. The student who has food poisoning, she wrote some advice for teachers. So I just wanted to have some student voice in this. So she wrote, the advice that, then she's a, just so you know, she's in her 30s, she has 5 kids, she has, you know, a full-time job, she's doing fantastically well, she's about to graduate, probably next semester. So the advice that I can give any teacher is be patient with the students. Depending on the school district where the student came from, there may be a little bit of a deficit or delay. I believe that all people can be taught, it just takes time. The developmental courses that the colleges have designed seem to be tedious and not very necessary when you start them. I've learned over time that everything that I was taught in these core classes have done nothing but boost my success in college. It taught me to be prepared for college-level work when it came along. I can honestly say without those core classes, I would not have been able to achieve the level that I reach now. The classes are designed to be geared towards students who don't quite remember or don't have the skills to perform work at a college level. I will say that college is a lot of work. You get out of it truly what you put in. You have to be willing to work hard and dedicate yourself to your studies. I started out with the lowest level of all developmental courses in reading and math, and by the time I made it to college level studies, I was more than prepared, earning A's and B's in all courses. I had to work really hard, but also dedication from teachers like Professor Gallagher and Higby made sure that success for all students was a top priority. If you were willing to put in the time to do your work, they were willing to dedicate the time to help you succeed. You never know how far you will go until you have someone who pushes you to levels that you thought you couldn't go. So that was it. I'll try not to cry. So just one concluding sentence, was just something to leave us with. I know this was kind of a free form kind of discussion. I'm not sure. So one thing you want to leave people with.
Words have power. So how we frame this development of education to our students is important. We need to think about that when we have these conversations once they get into our classrooms.
Okay.
Just if you haven't seen the Honey Badger video on YouTube, go watch it tonight. And I just want to say we all need to do that. We all need to just be like that on behalf of our students from a completion standpoint, from an equity standpoint. Go forth and honey badger.
Yes.
That video is scary if you haven't seen it. I just leave you with the words, believe in yourself, believe in your students.
Yeah.
All right. So thank you so much. Thank you.